I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to the second hour of Tiki and Tierney here on CBS Sports Radio. We're coming to you live from the Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans studio. Rocket Mortgage is with you every step of the way to provide a seamless mortgage experience. Tiki Barber sitting in solo for the week. BT's down on vacation. He'll be back next week. Unfortunately, I think he's going to miss out ending this NBA Finals. Think this thing goes five? Think it's over in five or over in six? We'll discuss a little bit later. Al Harrington, former NBA player, and I think he's still with the Big Three, will join us at our 5:20 Eastern, 2:20 Pacific time slot. Pierre McGuire is going to hit us up in about 15 minutes as well to talk about Game 7, which is coming up on Wednesday. Really, Game 6 is a recap. The Boston Bruins find a way in convincing fashion, even though one was an empty netter at the end of the game, to rebound against the St. Louis Blues. And who has the advantage right now? There's been a couple of blowouts, put that in relative terms, blowouts from the Bruins standpoint. But the Blues, they're trying to find their first ever NHL title. Will it happen? Pierre McGuire will give us the update. This is a non-NBA hour. Going to talk some tennis, going to talk some hockey, then we'll get football at the 40s, and we'll start with a little bit of tennis. Now, look, last Friday, I was playing golf in the morning. So I got up early, went up to Darien, Country Club of Darien, with one of my TV bosses, Ross Molloy. Thank you, Ross, for the round of golf. And we finished and came into the clubhouse, and the French Open was on. Now, Ross loves tennis. And so I think he played high school. He played, through college as well. Still plays now and in great shape. And he really wanted to watch tennis. And I've kind of forgotten how athletic some of these tennis players are, particularly the two that are likely in most people's minds, number one and two of all time. Some of that's based on winning. Some of that's just based on the aesthetic. And I'm talking about Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. Now, they were playing in the semifinal on Friday when we were watching this match, and it was windy as hell. It was like dust storms because it's on clay court, the French Open out in Roland Garros. And you could tell that this was not just, tennis that you see on a regular basis, because it was intense. Like, the environment was a big part of a character in the storyline. Now, Rafael Nadal won, obviously, as we all know by now. And he went on, this was the semifinal, he went on to win the final against a Dominic Thiem in relatively dominant fashion. And it just made me think about Roger Federer versus Rafael Nadal. Now, this is Nadal's unprecedented 12th French Open title. 12? He's only 33 years old. So think about that. If he came into the pros when he was, let's say, 20 years old, almost every year, except for like three or four, he's won the French Open title. It's amazing. It goes even deeper when you think about his record at Roland Garros is 93-2. He's lost two matches over the course of his career at the French Open. 93-2 is his record. And he's only 33 years old, and he's been so dominant, 92% winning percentage on clay in general. So it's what's earned him the nickname the King of Clay, and it's well deserved and it's well earned. And so I was like, why is he so dominant on clay? It's part two things. It's one of two things. One, clay is slow, so the ball doesn't fly off the court like it does off grass or off hard court, and so you got to be really meticulous in tennis. And we've seen this over the last 15 years or so. Not that I watch a lot of tennis, but if you watch any tennis, you see this. These guys are so overpowering. Right? They hit the ball so hard that they can smash a winner past you before you can get to it. Even if you're a good athlete and you play it just right, they're so strong, and service games are so strong that it's hard to catch up. But on clay, that's not the case because the ball hits and slows down and velocity comes off of it. So if you're a good athlete, really a great athlete like Rafael Nadal is, you can get to every shot. And so it makes you, as a opponent of him, have to think tactically because that's what he thinks. He says, look, this is not going to be a one or two volley point here. This is going to be a 4, 5, 6 volley point. And at some point, you're going to make a mistake, or at least I think you're going to make a mistake. You can't hit it past me because I'm athletic enough to get to everything, and clay slows it down. So I know I'm going to get there, and I'm just going to lob it back in. He's got that heavy top-end spin, right? He puts it right back into play and wait for you to make a mistake. And that's exactly what happened with Roger Federer. He beat Roger Federer 6-3, 4-2, and basically dominated. This is Roger Federer now, who, by the way, has 101 career victories. 101 career titles, 20 Grand Slam titles, including 8, an unprecedented 8 at Wimbledon. This is who a lot of people consider the greatest tennis player of all time because of his success. And in some regards, you could say this has a lot to do with his ability to play on all surfaces. Now, he's won 8 Wimbledons. I think he's won 4 U.S. Opens. He's won a couple of what's the other one, the Australian? The Australian, and but he's only won 1 French Open. Now, you might think the converse here. You might just say, well, he's just not a good clay court player. But that's not the truth. So here's his run at the French Open. In 05, he made the semis. In 06, he made the final. 07, he made the final. 08, he made the final. And 09, he won. Remember that one. And 9, he won. 10, he went to the quarterfinals. 11, went to the final. And then in semi, and there's a few others. And then he basically said, you know what, I'm done with the French Open. And he took time away. Basically, for the last 4 years, till this year, Roger Federer, one of the greatest players of all time, if not the greatest player of all time, has not played the French Open. You know why? Because those 4 finals appearances that I mentioned that he didn't win, he lost to Rafael Nadal. And the one that he did win, Rafael Nadal was hurt. So he knows that he can win and succeed on clay. He just can't beat Rafael Nadal on clay. Now, here's what happened and led up to the semifinal. Roger decided to play in this year's French Open. Why? Because off of clay, he had played Rafael Nadal 5 times, and he had beat him 5 straight times. So even if it was... I don't know. Even if it was psychological in his mind, he's saying, I think I've got Nadal's number. I think I know how to beat Rafael Nadal now. I know it's been on grass and it's been on hard courts, not on clay, but I think I figured out how to beat him. So he goes back and plays in the French Open in 2019, gets to the semifinals, and who does he draw? Obviously, Rafael Nadal. I just told you what happened. 6-3, 6-4, 6-2. He got obliterated by Rafael Nadal, which makes me question. Now, I know Federer is the greatest, and I just said that. 101 career victories, 20 Grand Slams. Nadal's very close behind. He's got 85 career victories and 18 Grand Slams. 12 of those Grand Slams, however, are at the French Open. 12. I mean, that's unprecedented. 12 Grand Slams at one place. He is the king of clay. Is he the master of clay? I think so. Jack of all trades, because he's won it. I think he has the career. Yeah, he does have the career Grand Slam. So jack of all trades in a sense, but he is the master of clay. And at 33, Roger Federer is going to be 38 in about a month and a half or so. At 33, he has plenty of time to catch him in Grand Slams. I mean, hell, you know he's going to win the French at least 2 more times, 3 or 4 more times possibly. And Roger Federer is getting to the age where, can you keep winning? Roger Federer is in our minds the greatest tennis champion of all time. I think Rafael Nadal is going to pass him. And when you look, consider his dominance on one surface, it's amazing. It's athleticism. It's perfection and precision. at one thing that I think a lot of people don't have the wherewithal to do. Hats off to Rafael Nadal, because the more I think about what kind of champion I'd rather have, I want to say Federer, but that's because I haven't paid attention. I watch it from afar. I hear it from afar. But when you dive into it and you watch it and you consider the head-to-head matches between Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer, Nadal holds the edge, 24-15 overall, and in Grand Slams, 10-3. 10-3. The greatest champion of all time, Roger Federer, seemingly can't hold a candle, especially on clay, to Rafael Nadal. Nadal, he's the man. Go ahead, Samter.
So I guess that's the real burning question. Like, Nadal has it's not like he's just beaten him a little bit. I mean, 10-3 in Grand Slams, 15.
Everybody has a kryptonite.
Yes, but it's not just, and here's what really, you know.
But he beat him 5 times in a row. Let's not forget that.
Sure, but what really stands out to me is not only has Nadal dominated Federer, but Djokovic, who's also considered one of the all-time greats, and we had Andre Agassi on last year or earlier in the year, and he said at the peak of play, the greatest tennis player he's ever seen was Novak Djokovic, right?
Yes.
Djokovic is 9-6 against Federer in Grand Slams and 25-22. So, like, you talk about Federer being the greatest ever.
It's because he's won a ton. It's accumulation of so think regular season and Grand Slam season. That's right. Basically what we're talking about in tennis. So he's got 101. It's
right.
Ridiculous.
But do you consider the greatest ever? I mean, especially in a sport like tennis.
Who wins head to head? That's what you got to look at, right?
So that's the question. Is it a matter of if Djokovic and Federer and Nadal were to play each other every single match of their careers, who's the best player? Or do you look at it like as the total of their career, 101 wins, 20 Grand Slams?
I think you have to think of the total of their career because it's playing a lot of different matches and a lot of different venues, a lot of different pressures. Federer is still there for me.
Does Nadal have to pass Federer or at least tie him in major wins to become the greatest of all time?
But the problem is by the time it's all said and done, Rafael Nadal, let's say he's got 5 more years, he in theory could get 3 away from Federer's record just by winning the French Open, which he's likely to do because he hasn't gone to a 5th set at the French Open. Think about that. He has not gone to a fifth set at the French Open in his victories. It's unbelievable, his dominance. You can't out-muscle him, and you can't outsmart him. He's a tactician. It's unbelievable. And I bring this up because I always talk about greatness and observing it and witnessing it. And it was almost by accident, because I played golf with my TV boss on Friday, that I got reintroduced to the greatness of Rafael Nadal. And you dig into his history and realize that 12, unprecedented, 12th French Open in amazing fashion against, even though he was in the semis, Roger Federer and others. You give him a clap. You really do. Game 6 of the NHL Finals was a doozy for the Blues, meaning a bad one. It was a great win for the Boston Bruins. They of the greatest, we could call, title town right now. Pierre Maguire is going to break down what happened in the previous 6 games and also what to expect in Game 7, which is on Wednesday. Tiki and Tierney here on CBS Sports Radio. CBS Sports Radio's toll-free line, 855-212-4227. It's brought to you by Geico. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. We transition from tennis and the French Open to the NHL and the Stanley Cup Finals. The St. Louis Blues, the Boston Bruins heading to Game 7. And to help us look at it, Pierre Maguire, NHL on NBC, their in-glass reporter, joins us again. Pierre, thanks for hopping on again with us. How you doing?
I'm doing excellent, Tiki. Nice to visit with you.
Oh, it is my pleasure, because you can give me some intel on what the heck, what in the world the Post-Dispatch was thinking by letting leak a bunch of messages that did nothing in Blues fans' minds but jinx them. jinxed them, right? Hey, this is congratulations, you know, in preparation of the outcome. I mean, all of us were here to remember when and how we felt when the Blues brought the cup home. What in the world were they thinking?
That's called quality control, and it's a problem. You know what? Bill Parcells would never have allowed that with the New York Giants. Bill Belichick would never allow it with the New England Patriots, and I'll take it a step further. We kind of went through something like this in 91 when we won in Pittsburgh in the Eastern Conference Final. We beat the Boston Bruins, and we were all in the coach's office. I was one of the guys in there, and I remember one of the hierarchies of the organization wanted to pop champagne, and the great Scotty Bowman, the winningest coach of all time in the NHL, said, "What are you doing?
Yeah.
Don't celebrate winning Eastern Conference titles. We celebrate winning Stanley Cups."
Yeah.
And it was not allowed to be popped. It's almost in the same vein. Why that would be done by people in St. Louis that really have never been part of anything like this. They didn't think they were doing anything wrong. Unfortunately, they didn't have the quality control to stop it and never should have got out.
Yeah, no, it is unfortunate. But it is for us that are, you know, aren't Blues fans or following hockey too closely. It's a great thing to dive into and say, see, you jinxed yourself. There you go. But you know, let's talk about the Blues, in particular their coach, Craig Berube, who back in game three. It was like 15 or like maybe it was even more penalties called. And he complained about it, right? He's like, hey, you let him play. And obviously we know what happened a couple games later. You get the tripping call that was not called, and they find a way to win that. You know, how much impact has the referees letting things play? Because the penalties have gone significantly down over the last three games. How much has that come into play in St. Louis's run towards almost getting the Stanley Cup?
Well, it's not just St. Louis. This has been going on for years in the National Hockey League where coaches try to intimidate the officials. You know, you're always looking for the next call. You know, you're trying to get under the referee's skin a little bit and get them to feel sorry for you or say, you know what, I fouled that one up, but I'm going to give you a break the next time. So it's been going on for a long time in our league. It's human nature. You're always challenging people. That's the nature of pro sports is the challenge. I don't think that really played a role in that. I just think the official missed it. It has not been a great year in the playoffs for the officials this year. But one of the things I'm going to say in defense of the officials, Tiki, this game has never been played faster. This is my 31st year in pro hockey.
Yeah.
I've been at it a long time. I've never seen it faster, ever. And it's a really hard game to call. You may think you see it one way, and then you see it in super slow motion on TV, and you say, oh, man, that wasn't like that at all. And so it just shows you that your eyes can play tricks on you. And I think we have to – there's got to be some rejigging of the refereeing system in our league. And I do think the competition committee is going to pay attention to that. And I do think we'll see some subtle changes that will probably enhance the referees' abilities to make some calls.
Pierre McGuire, NHL on NBC, In Glass Reporters, joining us here on Tiki and Tierney. Now, Bruce Cassidy said this is a black eye. I mean, is it? You talk about
yeah, that wasn't good. That was not good.
I mean, how do you fix it, Pierre? I mean, there's not enough space to put another ref. You know what I mean? So,
no.
Like, what do you do?
Here's my idea, Tiki. I proposed this a long time ago when I was actually coaching in the league. Rather than having two on-ice referees, you have one referee who's upstairs sitting in the press box. That creates more room on the ice. The linesmen call the lines and icing and break up fights if they have them and control the things away, the ancillary things. The referee on the ice has direct contact with the referee upstairs through an earpiece, an IFB. And that way they can communicate, and you basically have the on-ice official making a lot of decisions. But if things happen behind his back that he doesn't see, the man upstairs, the eye in the sky, can call down. Once players know that that can actually happen, you don't think they'll be on their best behavior?
Oh, yeah, you have to
get away with much. And not only that, but then you can have instantaneous reviews right upstairs with a certified official. And here's the last thing why I think that's a good idea. Guys' careers will be prolonged. Referees' careers will be prolonged because right now you got them down there and they're getting mutilated because of how fast the game is.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, even if a referee's injured, he can still work a game.
Yeah.
He can be upstairs.
Oh, that's interesting. You don't think about it that way, but it makes a perfect sense. And we'll be sure to you heard it here first on Tierney when they institute this, Pierre. I mean it makes sense because hockey is one of those sports. It's not like in the NFL where you know the sideline can give you some relief from the action. You know what I mean? If you're a referee and you got to chase a guy down the field, you can kind of just run on the side. You can't do that in hockey. You're in the middle of the action, no matter where you are.
You just said something that's so good, and just from you, obviously, your experience as a running back of football, but there's out of bounds in football. There's no out of bounds
that's
in hockey.
Great.
You run into a wall.
That's right. That's right.
You know, and you got guys carrying weapons and going at 35 miles an hour, and they can shoot the puck at over 100 miles an hour. So if you have no out of bounds and nowhere to hide, it can be an intimidating place to work and to play.
Yeah. Do you think Sam, my producer, brought this up, and it's an astute point. You talk about how fast hockey has become, and you see it in all sports because guys are just getting bigger and stronger and faster, etc. But in hockey, it particularly that way because you're on skates and on ice. Are refs making more mistakes later in games because they're just tired?
I think the answer is yes. I think if you look at, for instance, I did a game in the playoffs between San Jose and St. Louis. It was game 3, the dreaded hand pass that led to an overtime winning goal for San Jose. And everybody in the rink saw it except for the officials. But it's in double overtime. So the fatigue factor is clearly there. The other night in the third period, the official that missed the call, that's late in the third period of the game. So there's a fatigue factor. And he's been working since April the 6th, I think, is when the playoffs started. So any of the officials that got this deep, they've been working a lot, and they've had a lot of time zone travel. So the answer is yes. I think that's a really valid point, really valid.
Pierre McGuire from NBC, NHL on NBC, the Inglass reporter, joins us here. We're breaking down this. Now, Game 7, it's awesome. It's what you want in all sports, particularly in hockey. The Bruins have the advantage because they're home, which takes me to the St. Louis Blues, who are I'll say depressing 6-7 at home. And obviously game 6 was at home for them last night when they lost in bad fashion. But I mean, how do you explain that? Cause it should be the opposite, shouldn't it?
Yeah. The one thing about hockey though, I would say to be fair, home ice advantage doesn't count as much as when I was involved in it as a coach or as a player, Tiki, because in those days we had the Chicago Stadium where the ice surface was a little bit different, mm-hmm. the Odd in Buffalo where the ice surface was a little different, the Colisée in Quebec City where the ice was a little different, the old Boston Garden. So every rink kind of had its own identity, Tiki. Yeah. Sometimes the glass was high, sometimes the glass was low, but now everything's standardized in the league. Every rink is 200 by 85. So they're all cookie cutter.
Yeah.
So you basically and you know what it's like. You've played football in front of 100,000 people. Everybody thinks the crowd noise is intimidating. It might be at the start, but then it goes away.
Yeah, you're right. That's
it
right.
It dissipates. So, I mean, for fans, I get it. If you've never had that experience, it's a surreal experience. But that stuff dissipates. It goes away. And then it's just a game. So that's one of the reasons why I don't think we see these teams being intimidated about going on the road, because all the rinks are the same. Back when I was doing it, it was intimidating to go into some of those buildings. To go into the Spectrum in Philadelphia, that was a nasty place to go.
Yeah.
It was a scary place to go.
No, I believe it. Everything in Philadelphia was scary. The vet was scary back in the
well,
day.
Yeah, you would know.
Trust me.
You were part of some of the good.
Yeah, trust me. I know. Hey, kids and, you know, wife, you're not coming to that game. Trust me. Pierre, it's a good thing also for the Blues, by the way. They're 9-3 on the road, so it's not really that much of a disadvantage for them. Tuukka Rask was out of his mind yesterday. The save behind the back. I mean, like, how the heck do you even stick your hand behind your back when you got all the equipment on? But other than the goalies, and you can comment on Rask if you want to, but other than the goalies, what's going to be the difference for either one of these teams for Game 7?
Well, I think if St. Louis is going to win, one of the things they're going to be able to establish early is they're going to get their defense involved in the offense. And if they're doing that, that means they're not spending a lot of time defending. They're spending more time attacking. So that's one of the real identities of their team, is getting offense from their defense. If you see that from St. Louis, that means they're on their game.
Yep.
For Boston, Tiki, I really believe if you see them aggressive on the forecheck, if you see them spending a lot of time in the St. Louis zone, if you see them having no problem breaking the puck out of their own zone, St. Louis is going to be in a world of hurt. They're going to be in big trouble.
Interesting. The Boston Bruins have 6 championships. The St. Louis Blues obviously have 0. Experience plays a huge factor here? That's a question.
I think it plays a little bit of a factor, and I'll tell you why, Tiki. This was something that really impressed me by the Bruins management. They have 5 players left from their last championship team in 2011. And what they did was they brought pictures of all 5 of those players and hung them in different parts of their dressing room on the road.
That's cool.
So the players that have never won can see guys they are actually playing with having won, and they can tell stories about it, or they can ask questions about it. And it's been this galvanizing thing for their group, Tiki. I'm telling you, it's really been a smart thing that Bruce Cassidy and his coaching staff and Donnie Sweeney and Cam Neely, the president and the GM, what they've done with the team. By doing that, I think it's really brought the guys together. And you can see the young players for the Bruins are not nearly as intimidated by the moment because they have that experience to draw from.
Well, Pierre, I appreciate you hopping on with us again, as always. Game 7 is on NBC on Wednesday. We'll be tuning in. It's nothing like a Game 7 in hockey. I appreciate you, Pierre.
Anytime, Tiki. It's been my pleasure. And your brother, Rondé, always gets Kenny Albert and I a good restaurant to eat in Tampa, so I'm grateful for that.
Of course. Kenny's the man. Kenny will be on the call, by the way, if you're listening on the radio on Westwood One. So that's the tie-in as well. Take care, Pierre. We'll talk soon.
Great visiting with you, Tiki. Take care. Enjoy Game 7, everybody.
Most certainly. Pierre McGuire, NBC, NHL on NBC, in glass reporter. He's the best. Every time we call him, he comes and gives us all the insight we need for hockey because we don't follow it too much. Another GM was fired in the NFL after the draft. Is this a trend? And why is it happening now? Football at the 40s next. But first, here's an update from Richard Ackerman. Doing More is brought to you by The Home Depot, the next generation of home improvement with everything you need to do projects smarter. The Home Depot, more saving, more doing. Let's take a look at a player who is doing a lot more for his team. Vanderbilt Baseball was facing elimination on Saturday's game against Duke in the Super Regional. But freshman pitcher Kumar Rocker stepped up in a huge way. The 19-year-old hurler threw a no-hitter, the first ever in a Super Regional game, with a dominating 19 strikeouts to keep the number 2 Commodores alive. And thanks to a win yesterday, Vandy is now moving on to face Louisville in the first round of the College World Series. That's Doing More by the Home Depot. Samter, are you ready to get to football to 40? Because there's a lot of stories. I know we got like 13 or 14 minutes here to get through 8 of these, but I think a lot of these are important. You ready?
Sure am.
Let's hit it.
40-yard kick, right hash mark.
40 yards on the return.
A 40-yard touchdown.
40 yards.
You love football. We love football. So we give you football every day. It's Football at the 40 with Tiki and Tierney on CBS Sports Radio.
All right, Tiki, football at the 40. A lot to get into, especially with camps and OTAs going on around the league. One of the really good news signs that we've heard, and we kind of saw the report that Cam was throwing a regular-sized football on the sidelines. Well, it turns out, heading into mini camps, it looks like Cam is scheduled to throw during all quarterback drills.
That's encouraging.
And we remember all the situation with Andrew Luck a few years ago with his shoulder, how it always seemed like he was just never able to pick up the Duke. He was never able to fully get back out there and throw. So if you're the Panthers, how positive of a report is this for you?
Oh, you're encouraged, man. Look, because we remember, really, I'm just saying Cam is tougher than Andrew Luck. You can break it now. Just kidding. But I mean, it's one of those things that I think the damage was obviously significantly less for Cam Newton, and likely more of a result of trauma, like a blunt trauma, because he took so many hits from running, whereas Andrew Luck's was probably a lot more structural, and that's why it took much longer for it to come back the right way. But this is a good sign, and we talked about this maybe 2 weeks ago. Cam Newton, his game has changed. He doesn't have to have the cannon arm that he had earlier on in his career because that's just not how their offense is predicated right now. This is a great sign. Depending on, you know, how sore he is after the first couple of days, I think Cam should be good to go and back to the Cam that we have or we're used to seeing when he won the MVP or when he took his team to the Super Bowl. That was the fun Cam. The compromised Cam wasn't too much fun for fans or for Carolina Panthers.
Johnny Football is back in the news.
He's not Johnny Football anymore. He said he didn't want that any longer.
Oh, so Jonathan Manziel.
Thank you.
John Manziel.
John, yes.
John Manziel. Still trying to get back into professional football. He failed at the CFL. He didn't really do much in the AAF. And so I guess the next option is the XFL. And he was asked if he'd be willing to play for the local Houston team.
Yeah, I've been just in continuing my football career and in whatever capacity that is. And I think the opportunities will present themselves moving forward. And, you know, we'll look at that and make the decision what's best for my family. But at the end of the day, I'm 26 years old sitting here today. You know, I want to continue to play. And I have a drive and a passion to still play. So whatever opportunities present themselves, you know, I know I'll be ready for it. So, you know, just waiting and being patient.
He was also asked and talked about, he said, it's a stone's throw away from College Station. A lot of Aggies drove from Houston to College Station. Houston's a great city that will always be near and dear to my heart. The head coach there is June Jones.
Which could be a good thing or a bad thing.
He said, I enjoyed him from an offensive standpoint, from a personal standpoint. He's been there for me, especially when I was in Hamilton. So it seems like Houston could be an option for Manziel. Look, do you see him ever making it back to the NFL?
To the NFL, I think it's that ship has sailed. It's been too long. Every year we kind of kept it in the back of our mind, but he can be a draw for a startup league, the spring league that the XFL is going to be. You mentioned June Jones, who was formerly his coach at the Hamilton Tiger Cats up in the Canadian Football League. But let's not forget that they released him, and it didn't seem like it was under, I don't know, you know, you go your way and we're having a beer out the door. So I don't know if that relationship is one that will be, I think, strong enough to push this over the edge for Johnny Manziel or John Manziel to sign with the XFL. But I do love the fact that it draws into the college fan base that loves him down at Texas A&M. I mean, that's never going to go away. It's all of his flaws and everything that happened to him, his professional career, his college career was iconic. So I think he makes it in the XFL. I don't think he makes it back to the NFL.
This has been an interesting trend that we've seen over the past couple years. Mm-hmm. First starting in 2017 with the Bills firing GM Doug Whaley a day after the draft. Then we saw the Jets firing Mike Maccagnan this year just a couple weeks after the draft. Yep. And now the Houston Texans fired their GM Brian Gain after just one season a month after the draft. What the heck is going on, T?
Look, I think in some ways this is the changing power structure of front offices. Because I think about it old school, like a GM has total control over a roster, and the GM's like, these are my guys. I want this guy to do this and this guy to do that. Now you're getting these young, more analytic, focused head coaches who are deep football guys, and it's not, you know, my guy is bigger than your guy, so my guy's going to win. It's my guy has this specific skill which fits into this specific offense that I'm going to run, and he's going to have to do this specific thing on every single play. And if I don't have that guy, it's not going to work. That would be my gut. But what I think is happening is, you generally speaking, you get a new head coach, and in the Buffalo Bills case, it was a new owner as well, the Pegulas. Sean McDermott comes in as the head coach, and Doug Whaley's just kind of a figurehead. He's there to keep things in order while they make this transition. And so obviously he shows the door. Same thing happened with the Jets to an extent, except it seemed like Adam Gase didn't like Mike Maccagnan's spending of money because who knows? I think Le'Veon Bell fits any system, but maybe he doesn't fit Adam Gase's system, or it's just too much money to spend on the running back position. In the Texans' case, Bill O'Brien's been there for a while. There isn't an ownership change. And Brian Gain, who had bounced around a little bit, kind of is a sacrificial lamb in a sense here, because the front runner, Nick Caserio, who is with the New England Patriots, probably has a history with Bill from his time with the New England Patriots. So this seems like this is a relationship thing, has not really anything to do with a philosophical difference that Brian Gain had with Bill O'Brien or the Houston Texans.
Now, just real quick, one last question on that one. As a team, should you base your team, or should you put more of an emphasis on the GM building the roster or the coach coaching the players that are in there?
I think the coach should have more power, especially because these young coaches are doing specific things with their players. It's not now. Look, if you're talking about a center or a guard, it's one thing. But if you're talking about skill position players or even tight ends at this point, linebackers, etc., your coach kind of knows the exact type of player that he wants.
Another trend in GMing, as we will now make it a verb, after the Oakland Raiders decided to hire NFL Network's Mike Mayock. Looks like the Jets, Joe Douglas, their new GM, is considering his old friend at college. They played football together, Todd McShay, the NFL draft expert from ESPN. What do you think about this trend of having on-air personalities in front offices?
On-air personalities see the big picture. You know, sometimes when you're in a front office at any organization, you get myopic and you're just looking at you or your sphere right there. But if you're a TV, a personality, and you've scouted everybody, first of all, more relationships because you're out there all the time and people see you. But also you see it from a different capacity, which can be very valuable, I think, to GMs. I think this is a good idea.
Tyreek Hill, we've talked about this a few different times. He's not going to be charged. The case is now officially closed. There is no actual investigation into abuse against the child anymore. However, based on the NFL code of conduct, he could still be suspended if the NFL deems what he did or what he allegedly did, or they find that they believe that he did do these things.
Yeah.
Surprised here. What should the NFL do?
Look, the NFL,
based on what we've heard and seen.
The NFL, what should they do is they'll investigate it. I believe that something happened here, and that's all the NFL needs to make happen, make this suspension happen. Can they get away with it? Technically, yes. I think they should suspend him, but I don't think they should suspend him for the entirety of the required length, which I think is 6 games, the personal conduct policy. I think they should suspend him, though, because the image that he created is it's not a good one for the league or for him or the Kansas City Chiefs.
The Pittsburgh Steelers and their steel curtain defense hoping to bring the newest player into that legendary fold.
Doesn't sound like it's going to be steel curtain.
Well, it's certainly not steel curtain. It's more speed curtain almost, in
exactly.
a sense. And it's really interesting because T.J. Watt, brother of J.J. Watt, who's becoming a superstar of his own, an all-pro type defensive player, the Steelers drafted Devin Bush in the top 10, and T.J. Watt had some interesting comments about the speed of Mr. Bush.
He's not the biggest guy, but he definitely does walk with a presence and he walks with a purpose. And he's taking a good role in knowing all the plays and being able to call some plays for us. And he is quicker than snot, and he's been flying around and making a lot of good plays, so I'm excited for him.
Quicker than snot?
I mean,
not the analogy,
when you were to ask me the speed of snot, I would not have said quick.
Maybe quicker, quick as a sneeze?
Maybe that makes more sense.
Right.
Me and Disa were really breaking down the idea of fast snot.
He is fast. What do you run, a 4.42? I mean, he's going to be an impact player. He'll be sideline to sideline as long as he can muscle his way and diagnose his way through the bodies that are in that front seven. I think he can be a really good impact player because he can cover backs and tight ends out of the backfield as well.
A.J. Green, who has graced our show multiple times, has been with the Cincinnati Bengals for a very long time. And obviously there's questions about where he's going to be next year or even this year because of his contract situation. He spoke about it this weekend.
Cincinnati is home for me. I've been here, going on 9 years. This is home as much as, South Carolina. So that's all I know is Cincinnati. So, I can't see myself playing anywhere else or playing in any city. So hopefully I can be here for a couple more years. So, but we'll see on that part.
Do the Bengals have to trade him?
I mean, he was at some camp for kids. They're rocking Shawn Mendes in the background. I mean, okay. I thought you guys were playing football, not having a dance party. I would like to see A.J. Green finish his career as a Bengal. It's very rare that you get an all-time great of an organization that stays there for the entirety of his run in the league. But it looks like, and it feels like, the Bengals are in need of a rebuild. And if they want to get some assets, A.J. Green got a lot of good football left in him, and his window of excellence does not intersect with the Bengals. He's likely going to be traded. That's why that question was asked. I hope it doesn't, but I can see it happening.
That was Football at the 40 with Tiki and Tierney on CBS Sports Radio.
Magic versus Bird. Think of the legendary rivalries of the NBA. Could Kawhi and KD be the next version of that? We'll discuss. But that will require Kawhi to stay in Toronto and KD to stay in Golden State. Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.